But I'm giving the talk because we want suggestions, comments, questions, criticisms about what we're doing. So I'll begin by reviewing monotonicity theorems in general, and then I'll review the systems that we study in particular. And specifically, I'll discuss the form of the Weyl anomaly in our systems, which will then play the central role in our proof of a monotonicity theorem, which I'll just sketch briefly, and then I'll end with some summary and outlook. Okay, so generically in physics, when we go from microscopic or high-energy scales, the UV, down to macroscopic low-energy scales, the infrared, our intuition is that the number of degrees of freedom should decrease because massive modes will decouple. And specifically in quantum field theory, in a Wilsonian renormalization group flow, we integrate out degrees of freedom down to some scale. And when that scale falls below some mass thresholds, we integrate out the massive degrees of freedom, which then effectively decouple and affect physics at lower energies only indirectly, for example, through loops suppressed by powers of 1 over mass. Monotonicity theorems make this intuition precise for our G flows in quantum field theory. And in the best case scenario, well, okay, the two essential things that a monotonicity theorem should do. Number one, it should provide some precise way or some definition of the number of degrees of freedom, which in an interacting quantum field theory can be non-trivial. And then it should also provide some rigorous proof that the number so defined should decrease along the RG flow. And in the best case scenario, it will do these things for any strength of the coupling. So, hello, without, in particular, without relying on perturbation theory in any coupling. And so monotonicity theorems are important because they place stringent theoretical constraints on what's possible in RG flow. For example, they can eliminate, what are the name of those things? Limit cycles in the space of couplings, and they place important constraints on low energy physics. And to my knowledge, only 4 monotonicity theorems have been proven so far with any rigor, and it's an alphabet soup. So there's the C theorem for 2-dimensional QFTs, the F theorem for 3-dimensional QFTs, the A theorem for 4-dimensional QFTs, and the G theorem for 2-dimensional CFTs, conformal field theories, on a space with the boundary. And so what I'll do is I'll just go through each of these briefly just to tell you what they are and to highlight some things that will be useful to me later. Starting with the C theorem. This was proven by Zamolodnikov in 1986. This is for RG flows in renormalizable Euclidean quantum field theories in 2 dimensions. And I should say for the rest of the talk that I will be in Euclidean signature. And so aside from renormalizability, Zamolodnikov made 3 crucial assumptions. One was Euclidean symmetry. That means rotations and translations. Or in Lorentzian signature, it would be Poincaré symmetry. Number 2 is locality. And number 3 is reflection positivity, which is just the Euclidean version, basically, of unitarity. So I'll go through each of these briefly, just to explain what they are. So to explain Euclidean symmetry, actually, I'll begin by introducing a non-dynamical background metric G mu nu. I will assume the existence of an action functional S, which will be a functional of the metric and of some set of coupling constants, lambda 1, lambda 2. And then technically, it's also a functional of the fields that we integrate over, but I'll ignore that. And I will also assume the existence of a generating functional Z, which is a functional, again, of the metric and the coupling constants. So I can define the stress energy tensor. T mu nu is just minus 2 over root G. That's the determinant of the metric. And then the variation with respect to the inverse metric of log of Z, that definition tells me T mu nu is symmetric. And then if I set the metric just to be the flat Euclidean metric, the translational and rotational symmetry of this metric tells me that the stress energy tensor is conserved. So that's the key thing I need. And then also, just because I'm in Euclidean signature, I can use complex coordinates, z and z bar. So then my stress energy tensor has these components, zz, z bar, zz bar, and z bar z. And it's symmetric, so zz bar is the same as z bar z. And then the trace is just either one of these off-diagonal elements in these coordinates. All right, so number 2 is locality. This is with a flat metric. So this means I can write my action functional as an integral of some local Lagrangian density L. And then in the C theorem, we consider RG flows that are triggered by a relevant local scalar operator. So I imagine I start with my Lagrangian of my UV theory. And then I perturb by some operator O, which is local. It depends only on one point. It's a scalar of the Euclidean symmetry. And it's relevant. So its dimension in 2 dimensions, its dimension is less than 2. And I have some dimensionful coupling lambda. So this perturbation preserves Euclidean symmetry. And then number three is reflection positivity. So in quantum mechanics, unitarity demands that the norm of some state squared should be non-negative. And reflection positivity is a similar statement for Euclidean quantum field theory. And for the purposes of this talk, it's just the statement that the two-point function of a local scalar operator in a Euclidean QFT must be non-negative. Technically, so that the Lorentzian signature theory will be unitary. So it's this statement here. And intuitively, I like to think of this as the statement that Euclidean time evolution in this x direction preserves the statement that the norm is non-negative. Okay, so the C theorem is a statement about an RG flow between fixed points. The fixed points will be conformal field theories, CFTs, so there's some flow from a UV CFT to an IR CFT between these two fixed points. I'll just remind you of a few things that I'll need about CFTs. So again, I'll introduce a non-dynamical background metric. So a conformal transformation is just a diffeomorphism, so x goes to some x prime, such that the metric changes only by some overall conformal factor, e to the 2 omega, which depends on x. And so just taking this transformation of the metric and plugging it into the definition of the stress energy tensor, you find that the trace is 1 over root g of the stress energy tensor is 1 over root g, and then the variation of log z with respect to this omega, the Weyl parameter. So if my theory is conformally invariant, this variation should vanish, and so conformal invariance tells me that the trace should vanish. I assume most of you have heard this before. So then in dimension greater than 2, the conformal group is generated by rotations and translations. This is the Euclidean symmetry. And then also by dilatations and special conformal transformations together, these generate the conformal group in Euclidean signature, which is SOD plus 1 comma 1. But then two dimensions is special. For one thing, because any holomorphic map of the coordinates is a conformal transformation. And also because the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sectors decouple. So here's my conservation equation. That's two real equations, which I can write as a single complex equation. And then if I have a conformal theory, then the trace vanishes, so this term goes away, which immediately tells me that z bar z bar component is, hope I got this right, holomorphic. Wait, anti-holomorphic, and ZZ is holomorphic. So they decouple. Then the generators of the conformal group are these Lorentz coefficients of the stress energy tensor, Ln and Ln bar. And these obey a Virasoro algebra, one for the holomorphic sector, one for the anti-holomorphic sector, with some central charge C, and they commute with each other. And the point here that I want to make is just that this is an infinite number of symmetry generators, which is special to two dimensions. This does not happen in higher dimensions, although this part of the conformal group, the SOD plus 1 comma 1, shows up as the SO3 comma 1 generated by L plus or minus 1 and L0 and their anti-holomorphic counterparts. Now, the central charge C is the main object in the C theorem, and it counts the number of degrees of freedom in the CFT in a couple of different ways. So one is, just for example, if we have a CFT and we add to it a single real free massless scalar field or a Dirac fermion, then C will increase by 1, so this tells us at least that it can count the number of free fields. It also shows up in the thermodynamic entropy. So as Cardi showed in 1986, if I have a system of spatial size L at temperature T in some regime where T is much greater than 1 over L, then the thermodynamic entropy takes this form. So it's proportional to L, or it's extensive in volume. And then dimensional analysis tells me it has to go as T. Then the number in front is proportional to the central charge C. So C also provides some measure of the number of thermodynamic degrees of freedom. And then C also shows up in the entanglement entropy. And I assume all of you know what this is. If you don't, you can ask me later. So if I introduce a short distance cutoff A and I consider an interval of length L and compute the entanglement with the rest of the CFT, the entanglement entropy takes this form, log of 2L over A times C over 3. And this is obviously cutoff dependent, but the claim is that the coefficient is cutoff independent. So if I shift the cutoff, this coefficient won't change. And therefore, at least it's observable, at least in principle. And so C is giving me some measure of the entangled or the correlated degrees of freedom in my CFT. So this one number fixes all these different quantities. And moreover, unitarity constrains C to be bounded from below. So if I demand that the norm of any state squared should be non-negative, I can consider the vacuum states of my CFT, which is defined as the state annihilated by all the Virasoro generators with M non-negative. So then if I construct a state by acting on the vacuum with L minus M, again with M non-negative, I can just compute this norm squared turns out to be a positive number times C. So if I demand this is non-negative, then C has to be non-negative. So unitarity or reflection positivity requires C to be bounded from below by zero. And this makes sense for something that should be counting degrees of freedom. A number of degrees of freedom intuitively should not become negative. Right, okay, so now I'll give a sketch of a proof of the C theorem in just a couple of slides. And I should say this is stolen from John Carty's textbook. So the first step is to write the two-point functions of the stress energy tensor, and just using the Euclidean symmetry, you can constrain them just knowing that TZZ is spin 2 and T mu mu is spin 0. So the two-point function of TZZ should go as some function f of ZZ bar, that's rotationally invariant, over z to the fourth. TZZ with the trace should be some function g of ZZ bar over z cubed z bar. And then the two-point function of the trace itself should be h of ZZ bar over z squared z bar squared. So first of all, at a fixed point, because the trace vanishes, that's an operator statement, so it should be true in these correlation functions. So g and h vanish at a fixed point. And then you can do a calculation, and you'll find that f at a fixed point reduces to c over 2. So here's the central charge again. This is another sense in which it counts degrees of freedom. It sets the normalization of the two-point function of the stress energy tensor. And then reflection positivity, because the trace is a scalar, reflection positivity tells me that h must be non-negative. And that's how I'm going to get an inequality in the next couple of slides. Right, so for the C theorem, the main object is this, what's called the C function, which is a particular linear combination of F, G, and H. So where does this linear combination come from? So first of all, this factor of 2 comes from the fact that at the fixed point, G and H will vanish, and F becomes C over 2. So at a fixed point, this big C, the C function, reduces to the central charge. Where does the rest of this come from, G and H, these factors in front of them? Well, we look at the conservation equation, which again, we can write in complex coordinates like this. And if we multiply by factors of TZZ at the origin and TZ bar Z at the origin and take expectation values to construct two-point functions, then this equation we can write gives us these two real equations, where R here is just the radial coordinates in the Euclidean plane. We're one step away. We have one more step. All we have to do is take these two equations and eliminate g from them, and we get our C theorem. So we find this equation, dc dr times r equals minus 3 halves h. And of course, we know h must be non-negative, so it tells us that this derivative is non-positive. And so this is the C theorem in real space. It's saying if we go from short distances to long distances, this function c is strictly decreasing. And that's sometimes called the strong form of the C theorem, because I've defined this quantity it's defined everywhere along the RG flow, not just at the fixed points, and I can show, or Zamolodchikov can show, that it's monotonically decreasing. And of course, that implies what's called the weak form, which is just a statement about the fixed points, just saying that the central charge in the UV must be greater than or equals to the central charge in the IR. And so for most of the rest of the talk, I'm only going to discuss weak forms of monotonicity theorems. And then there are other proofs of the C theorem. As far as I know, there's only four. Well, to my knowledge, there's four. One is using holography. And in that case, the crucial inequality comes from the null energy condition. And that proof only gives you a weak form. There's an proof using entanglement entropy. There, the crucial inequality is strong subadditivity. That actually gives you a strong form. You do get a C function, although its relation to Zamolodchikov's C function is not clear, as far as I know. And then there's a third method, which I call vial anomaly matching, where the crucial inequality is, again, reflection positivity, but you only get a weak form of the C theorem. And I'm going to discuss this method more later in the talk. And of course, the interesting question is, what about generalizations? So what if I relax some of the assumptions? So what if my theory is not local, or it's non-unitary? Or what if I have a quantum field theory with less symmetry? So for example, what if I'm in higher dimensions, where the fixed points do not have an infinite number of symmetry generators? Or what if I don't have Euclidean symmetry? For example, what if the number of dimensions is different in the IR than in the infrared? The UV than in the infrared. What if the relevant operator that I use to trigger the flow is not a scalar? What if it's a vector or something else, which will break Euclidean symmetry? Or what if the fixed points are not CFTs, but rather they have Lifshitz scaling where, well, I'm in Euclidean signature, but just imagine one of the coordinates is time. Time and space scale differently. as parameterized by some dynamical exponent z. And in fact, what if I have an RG flow where the value of z is different at the UV and IR fixed point?
I think it could be used for a Sorrow symmetry
on
the
roof. Not really anywhere.
Okay, so I'm curious why you mentioned that.
The main point was just to emphasize that in two dimensions there's an infinite.
Right, but which point of the proof do you use that?
I don't really think anywhere, except maybe the existence of this central charge, which I think ultimately is defined.
Right, so it's not charge. Crucial in the, when you go through the generalization.
Wrong. Yeah, that might be true. I mean, the crucial thing is probably really more that it's two-dimensional, and so you can introduce these complex coordinates. Question is, why is it harder in higher dimensions?
I don't know if you want to say homomorphicity was more important, but
no. I mean, in my mind, the reason it's harder in higher dimensions, really, it's not so much the Virasoro. It's just the fact that in two dimensions is kind of a very special case because you have one number, the central charge, that fixes so many different things, thermodynamic entropy, entanglement entropy, et cetera. And generically, in higher dimensions, that's not true. And so you have to decide which one of these things am I going to attempt to prove is monotonic. And a priori, it's not clear, and it's not easy just to prove that something is monotonic. Yeah, so actually, I'm not so sure the Virasoro symmetry itself. Anyhow, I'll keep going. To my knowledge, the only case question where any real progress has been made is the case of higher dimensions. And I guess difficult for the reasons we just discussed. So in one dimension higher, there's the F theorem proposed by Jafaris, Klebanov, Pufu, and Safdie in 2011, proven by Cassini and Huerta in 2012. This is for RG flows and renormalizable Euclidean symmetric local quantum field theories in three dimensions. And what is F? Well, at a fixed point, CFT, you perform a conformal map to a three-sphere. And then F is defined as minus log of the renormalized partition function of the CFT on S3. And the statement of the F theorem is just that F at the UV fixed point is greater than or equals to F at the IR fixed point. This was proven by Cassini and Huerta using entanglement entropy. And again, the crucial inequality was strong subadditivity. And they only get this weak form of the F theorem, and it's an open question how to generalize this to get a strong form. And it was also proven in holography, again, using the null energy condition, which, and that also just gives you a weak form. And then in four dimensions, there's the A theorem proposed by Cardi in 1988 and proven by Komorgadsky and Schwimmer in 2011. This is for RG flows and renormalizable Euclidean symmetric local quantum field theories in four dimensions. And so what is A in this case? And this also kind of gets back to your question. The question was, well, what quantity should we target for a proof? And Cardi's answer was the Weyl anomaly. So just to briefly explain what this is. So if you consider a CFT in any number of dimensions with the trivial metric, as I said, conformal invariance demands that the trace vanish. But if I introduce a non-trivial metric, then quantum effects can break conformal invariance, producing a non-zero trace. That is the Weyl anomaly, or trace anomaly. And in four dimensions, the trace anomaly takes this form with these two terms. One is the Euler density built from the metric. The other is the square of the Weyl tensor. And these come with coefficients A and C, which are called the central charges of the 4D CFT, two of the numbers that characterize the 4D CFT. And the A theorem, of course, is a statement about A, that it must be bigger in the UV than in the IR at the fixed points. Proven by Komorgadsky and Schwimmer using Weyl anomaly matching, again, relying on reflection positivity. They only get this weak form, and again, proven in holography, which again, just gives you a weak form. And then the one that I'm really interested in, and maybe not the best known, is the G theorem. This was proposed by Affleck and Ludwig in 1991, and then proven by Friedan and Konechny in 2003. This one is for a local reflection positive CFT in two dimensions on a space with a boundary. So I'll always have just a linear or a flat boundary. So I'll have two dimensions, x and y, and my boundary will be at x equals 0. So the boundary will be the y-axis. And of course, you can't just put a CFT on a space with the boundary. You have to worry about the boundary conditions. And if you want to preserve conformal symmetry, then you have to impose conformally invariant boundary conditions. So for example, for a free massless field, it could be Neumann or Dirichlet. And a CFT on a space with a boundary with conformally invariant boundary conditions is called a boundary CFT or BCFT. So the G theorem is for BCFTs in two dimensions. And in particular, it's for what's called a boundary RG flow. So the idea is that I start with some UV BCFT, so a CFT with some boundary condition. Let's just give it a generic name, alpha, you know, Neumann, Dirichlet, or whatever. And then I perturb it by an operator O localized at the boundary. This is why it's a boundary RG flow, and relevant with respect to the boundary, so some operator of dimension less than 1. And that will trigger some RG flow, and the key point here is that the bulk CFT will not change. And intuitively, that's just because, you know, physics infinitely far, as long as I do a local perturbation like this, the physics infinitely far away, the boundary shouldn't change, as long as I have a local theory. So the idea is that in the infrared, what I'll get is the same bulk CFT, still on a space with a boundary, but generically with a different boundary condition, let's call it beta. So I'll have some boundary RG flow between, essentially between boundary conditions. And I'll give examples of this later, or one example. Right, so a crucial point about these boundary RG flows is that under such a boundary RG flow, the bulk theory remains conformal. So let me explain what that means. So in a theory, so now, in a quantum field theory on a space with a boundary, the stress energy tensor generically will split up into two terms. One is the bulk term, and there's a boundary term. And what I want to emphasize is that this boundary term localized at the boundary is not just the bulk term evaluated at the boundary or pulled back to the boundary or anything like that. This is the most general form you can write. And so a priori, these are two independent tensors. Although Ward identities relate them to each other. So for example, if you demand that your generating functional is invariant under diffeomorphisms along the boundary, meaning generated by a vector field whose only non-zero components are along the boundary, then you'll find some constraints. So for example, this boundary stress energy tensor, if it has an index in the normal direction, where both indices are in the normal direction, those components have to vanish. And moreover, it's not conserved generically. So its conservation or non-conservation equation looks like this. Its divergence will be proportional to the T perp component of the bulk stress energy tensor. And this is evaluated at the boundary. I'm not actually going to use this. I'm trying to give you some idea of what these things mean. The statement that the bulk theory remains conformal under a boundary RG flow is just the statement that the bulk trace will vanish along this RG flow, so that the only contribution to the trace will come from the trace of this boundary stress energy tensor. That's actually, well, I'm not going to go through all of Friedan and Konechny's proof, but that's a crucial fact. So then what is G of the G theorem? So at the fixed point BCFT, you can formally map your 2D BCFT to a disk with some boundary condition alpha at the boundary. And then G is defined as the renormalized partition function of the theory on a disk with boundary condition alpha. And then you can define what's called the boundary entropy, which is just the log of G, which intuitively counts the degrees of freedom localized at the boundary. But I emphasize it's sensitive to the boundary conditions of bulk fields. And that's what this subscript is supposed to indicate. So in what sense does it count degrees of freedom? Well, it's very similar to the central charge in two dimensions. So if you compute, say, thermodynamic entropy, again, for a system of size L at temperature T in some high temperature limit, you'll find the same bulk contribution, Cardy's result. But you'll also find this log of G. So you'll find the boundary entropy. And it's independent of the size, which is consistent with the intuition that it's associated with degrees of freedom at the boundary. So it doesn't care how big the system is. And also, it survives at zero temperature. So it's sometimes called the ground state degeneracy. But it provides some number of the thermodynamic degrees of freedom at the boundary. Also, if you compute entanglement entropy, now in a BCFT, for an interval including the boundary, what you'll find is 1/2 of the bulk CFT results plus this log of G. And just to be clear, this gives you some measure of the entangled or correlated degrees of freedom at the boundary. And of course, this doesn't look physical, because if I shift my cutoff A, I can change the value of log G. So really, what you're supposed to do is just take some kind of precise difference between this result for the BCFT and then subtract off 1/2 of the CFT result, including all the higher order terms. And then all the cutoff dependence is supposed to cancel out and give you something physical. Right, so then the actual G theorem, okay, I'm not going to go through it because it's more complicated than Zamolodchikov's case, mainly because you have less symmetry, because the boundary is breaking translations normal in the normal direction. But I'll tell you what they're able to do. So they're able to define a G function, which I call big G, and then using the symmetry of the problem, which really means translations along the boundary, and locality and reflection positivity, they are able to prove a strong form of the G theorem. They're able to prove that this dGdr is strictly decreasing, which of course then implies a weak form, that G in the UV must be greater than or equals to G in the IR for these boundary RG flows. Okay, so the question then, now that you know what the G theorem is, one more thing. A difference from the C theorem is that in this case, they can't prove that the boundary entropy is bounded from below. And it's also not even clear that it should be, because, for example, here, if you could, you know, a reasonable demand would be that the thermodynamic entropy should be positive. But then it looks like nothing prevents this thing from becoming negative as long as the bulk contribution remains bigger, so that the sum remains positive. And in fact, if you really take the thermodynamic limit of L goes to infinity, then it seems like there is no lower bound on log of G. So it's not clear that it should be bounded from below, and nobody's been able to prove one way or the other whether it is. Yeah, that's the
so
other
one.
So
I expect that to be possible?
No. Maybe. Might be some normalization issue. I'll have to get back to you. But one of the main points they make in their paper, I mean, I'm just quoting to you, is this fact that they can't prove it's bounded from below. And in fact, well, okay, I won't get into it. Right, okay. So the question that we posed to ourselves, again, was a question of generalizations, and in particular, what about higher dimensional G theorems? And hopefully you know what that means. There's a number of proposals in the literature. I've just listed a few of them here, including one that we made last year. I don't know if Gaiotto is here. Maybe he's somewhere in the building. I don't know. There's one. And people have done many tests of particular examples in these papers and in some other places. But nobody has a rigorous proof yet. And so the goal of the talk, what I'm going to try to do is present a sketch for a proof of a G theorem for a local reflection positive BCFT in three dimensions, based essentially on a similar proposal in this paper by Taki and Nagi in 2012, and also our paper from last year. And the method I'm going to use is this Weyl anomaly matching of Comer, Godskin, and Schwimmer. So I'm going to explain this in the rest of the talk, but before I do, I'll try to explain why you should care. So what are some three-dimensional BCFTs? One example is graphene with a boundary. So at least at leading approximation, graphene is described at low energies by a CFT, massless free Dirac fermions in three dimensions. And there are interesting boundary RG flows in graphene. Another example is the critical easing model in three dimensions with the boundary, which also has non-trivial boundary RG flows. And then more abstractly, in M theory, you can think of M2 brains or ABJM theory with the boundary. So M2s ending on M2s or M2s ending on M5s. In the latter case might tell us something about self-dual strings. And then just more generally and related to this, in string theory, there are various brain intersections that give rise to a three-dimensional BCFT with non-trivial boundary RG flows. And then related to both of these, in holography, there are examples, three-dimensional BCFTs with non-trivial boundary RG flows. And so any G theorem that you can prove for these cases will constrain the low-energy physics of these systems and others. Right, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe just in a little more detail these the systems that we're going to study and the form of the Weyl anomaly, which will be the central actor in our G theorem. So I'm interested in these BCFTs in three dimensions, and I'm only going to consider a planar boundary. So I'll have three dimensions, x, y, and z, and my boundary will be at x equals 0, so it's the yz plane at x equals 0. A three-dimensional CFT has SO4, comma 1. The conformal group is SO4, comma 1. But of course, the boundary breaks that symmetry, and it breaks it down to a subgroup, the subgroup that preserves the location of the boundary, x equals 0. This goes back to Cardi. This happens in two dimensions. This happens in any number of dimensions. So what is that subgroup? So rotations will obviously be broken to rotations just in the YZ plane. Translations will be broken to translations in the YZ plane. Dilatations are unbroken, and they act the same way on all the coordinates. And then the special conformals, I didn't mention this, but in the special conformal transformation, there's this real vector b mu, which parameterizes the transformation. And if my boundary is at x equals 0, these get broken to the subgroup that has bx equals 0. Just hopefully you can see just looking at the numerator, that will be the subgroup that preserves x equals 0. So in short, the three-dimensional conformal group gets broken down to SO3, 1, this subgroup of the two-dimensional conformal group. So that will be my symmetry of the problem. And then, as in the G theorem, we're interested in boundary RG flow, so we'll start with some UV BCFT, and we'll perturb by some operator O. It's local. It's localized at the boundary. There's a delta function here. It's a scalar of the the Euclidean subgroup of SO3, 1, Euclidean symmetry of the problem. And it's relevant with respect to the boundary, so its dimension is less than 2. And as in two dimensions, when we do this boundary RG flow, the bulk theory will remain conformal, so my stress energy tensor will have bulk and boundary contributions, and the bulk trace will always vanish. The only contribution to the trace will come from the boundary. All right, okay, so here's an example of a boundary RG flow. This is the simplest possible example. So you can consider a UVB CFT that's just given by a single real free massless scalar with Neumann boundary conditions. And then you can do a boundary RG flow where at the boundary, you just add what looks like a mass term for the scalar. And then what will happen is that in the infrared, you'll find the same bulk theory, a single real free massless scalar field, but the boundary condition will change. It will become Dirichlet. And intuitively, the reason should be obvious that up here, a Neumann boundary condition means that the value of the scalar at the boundary is free to change. So in some sense, you have this excitation, but then you are explicitly gapping that excitation. So that by the time you get to the infrared or to zero energy, because of this mass gap, you're not allowed to change. There's some energy cost to changing the value of the scalar at the boundary, and that's a Dirichlet boundary condition. It's not allowed to fluctuate anymore. Right, so we want to prove some G theorem. We're going to use Weyl anomaly matching, so I have to tell you what is the Weyl anomaly in these systems. And I should say, we're going to use this Weyl anomaly matching technique, and my point here is that, as in Komorgatsky and Schwimmer's case, reflection positivity will be one of the key ingredients, and we're only going to get a weak form of a G theorem. We'll have all the benefits, all the advantages and disadvantages of their method. In particular, we'll just get a weak form. So I have to tell you what the Weyl anomaly is in our system. And I guess I told you this part. You know what the Weyl anomaly is. Okay. So, right, the question is, what is the general form of the trace or Weyl anomaly in a generic system, let's say? So this is a textbook exercise. So this is Polchinski chapter 3. You do it in three steps. Step number one is to write down all the curvature invariants built from the metric that have the correct dimension to contribute to the trace. And this is just because if I have a theory that's a CFT in flat space, it has no intrinsic scale. So the only dimensionful things that could enter in the trace come from the curvature. So for example, in four dimensions, you can write down Riemann squared, Ricci tensor squared, Ricci scalar squared, et cetera, with some coefficients that a priori are undetermined, some set of real numbers. And you want to try and constrain those coefficients as much as possible. So step number two is to impose what's called the Wess-Zimino consistency condition. And ultimately, it's just the statement that if I do two successive conformal transformations, they should commute. So if I do a transformation with omega 1 and then omega 2, it should be the same as doing omega 2 first and then omega 1, which sounds trivial, but it actually is not in this case because these curvature invariants generically have very complicated Weyl transformations. So if you impose this consistency condition, it actually allows you to fix or eliminate some of these coefficients. And then step number three is to add local counterterms built from the curvature to the action functional, determine how they enter the trace, and then fix their coefficients of those counterterms to to eliminate more of these coefficients. So you go through these three steps, and what's ever left over is the most general form of the Weyl anomaly. So for example, if D is odd, then already in step one, there's nothing you can write down with the right dimensions, so there just is no Weyl anomaly. In even dimensions, you can get something non-zero. For example, in two dimensions, you can get the Ricci scalar times central charge over 24 pi. So here again, the central charge is showing up. And then in four dimensions, you can get the form that I wrote before. And in four dimensions, this actually gives me the chance to explain the difference between type A and type B terms. So West's amino consistency actually requires that if you do a conformal transformation, the integrated trace anomaly must be invariant. And that can happen in two different ways, giving rise to two types of terms, what are called type A and type B. So type A, which for example includes this Euler density term, type A means it changes by a total derivative under a conformal transformation, so that when you integrate, it's invariant. And type B is just a term that's just plain invariant. And there are more sophisticated ways to characterize these as whether the solution of the West amino consistency condition is trivial or not, and there's some cohomology you can define. I'm not gonna need any of that.
I believe you're missing one anomaly for parity.
Yeah, I'm assuming parity, I guess. Now, in our case, for a BCFT in three dimensions, again, the trace splits up into these two terms, and there will be no bulk Weyl anomaly because it's a three-dimensional bulk. So the question in our case really is, what's the general form of this boundary trace anomaly, or the boundary contribution to the trace anomaly? And so you can go through the three steps that I mentioned. Well, to explain how to do this, I have to explain a little bit, or just remind you a little bit about the geometry of submanifolds. So mathematically, we think of this boundary as a manifold that we are embedding into the three-dimensional space. So we give it some world sheet coordinates, sigma 1 and sigma 2, and there's some target space x mu, and then we describe the embedding by some mapping from the target space, from the world sheet into the target space. And given that embedding, we can define an induced metric in the usual way. I'm going to call it g hat ab, just as defined as the pullback, the bulk metric, and then from that we can define all the intrinsic curvature data like the Riemann tensor, Ricci tensor, Ricci scalar, and so on. But because it's a submanifold, we also have to worry about the extrinsic curvature, also known as the second fundamental form, which in Gaussian normal coordinates, which I can define at least close enough to the boundary, is just this KAB, which is just 1/2 times the normal derivative of the induced metric. So it tells me something about how this manifold the geometry changes as you move in the normal direction. And then I can also just define what's called the mean curvature, which is a K, which is just a trace of KAB. Right, so given these ingredients, okay, these are the geometric objects that you have to do step number one. So you go through the three steps, and actually Christian went through the three steps and found the results, and then we realized it had already been done by Schrimmer and Tyson in 2008 in a paper on a different subject. For them, it was just one step of a longer calculation. But Schrimmer and Tyson were not the first. Other people had studied various aspects of this. They had looked at particular cases going back to 1998. And in particular, Graham and Witten had studied these types of anomalies. And so sometimes they're called Graham-Witten anomalies, even though lots of other people studied them. So the point is, I can just tell you the answer. So you go through the three steps. What do you get? Well, here's the answer. So you find two terms. The first one is not surprising if you know the form of an anomaly in a 2D CFT. It's the Ricci scalar of the induced metric. But there is a term involving extrinsic curvature. And technically, this is the traceless parts of the extrinsic curvature squared. And you have these two terms, and they come with a priori undetermined coefficients, C1 and C2, which we call the boundary central charges. So these are two real numbers that are part of the data that characterizes the BCFT. And the crucial point for me is that, so this term, the Ricci scalar term, is obviously type A because it changes by a total derivative under a conformal transformation. And although it's not immediately obvious, the second term, the extrinsic curvature term, is actually type B. It's just invariant under a conformal transformation. I can say, well, I don't know how much time I have, but This term actually has a long history, both in math and physics. You can ask me later. I'll just say that in physics, the integral of this is sometimes called the Polyakov rigid string action. And in math, the integral of this is called the Willmore invariant, and it's related to the Willmore conjecture. But I'm not going to need any of that. Right, so the goal for the last part of the talk, now that we know the form of this Weyl anomaly, what I'm going to try to convince you is that under a boundary RG flow, we can prove a monotonicity theorem for this coefficient C1. That it must be bigger in the UV than in the infrared, which is essentially the proposal, or it's equivalent to the proposals made by Takinagi and collaborators and by us last year. Right, so now I'm going to sketch the proof. And I'm going to use this method of Weyl anomaly matching from Comer, Gottsky, and Schwimmer, so let me briefly review what that is. So, yeah. Because it's type A. You'll see in the proof. It's because it's a type A term. It's for the same reason that it's in the 2D CFT case that it's C, I should say in the four-dimensional case, but it's A and not C. The reason C, or at least you can't prove, first of all, there are counterexamples where people show that C is bigger in the infrared, but you can't prove that C, a monotonicity theorem for C because it's a type B term, at least using this method. It will become clear. The fact that it changes by a total derivative is the crucial thing. So they considered local reflection positive quantum field theories in any number of dimensions in some RG flow between fixed point CFTs. And the key ingredient was this field called the dilaton. So first of all, I'll introduce a non-dynamical background metric again. And then the dilaton, for the purposes of this talk, will be a non-dynamical background scalar field tau. And it's defined by two properties. One is that under a conformal transformation, it shifts linearly. So it actually looks like a Goldstone boson. And in fact, in cases where, I guess, dilatation symmetry is broken spontaneously, this actually would be the dynamical Goldstone boson of that broken symmetry. But in this talk, I'll treat it as a background field. So it's not dynamical. And the other property that defines tau is that in the Lagrangian, for any relevant coupling, lambda O, we introduce tau in the following way. So we introduce a factor of E to the delta dimension of O minus D times tau. And so what does this do? Well, effectively what this does is it promotes the coupling constants to functions of space, and furthermore gives them or endows them with a transformation property that will actually restore conformal invariance. And we'll see that in just a minute. So I'm going to explain that in some more detail. So a couple of consequences follow from this definition. One of them is just a pretty simple one, that if you introduce tau in this way and then take your Lagrangian with tau and Taylor expand it in powers of tau, you'll find that tau couples linearly to the trace of the stress energy tensor of the theory without tau. So the linear term just involves this trace. And then another consequence is this Weyl anomaly matching. First thing I'll say is that the Weyl anomaly is only non-trivial in even dimensions, so this Weyl anomaly matching is only non-trivial in even dimensions, so I will assume that starting now. And so to explain Weyl anomaly matching, let's do the following. So let's imagine we have our RG flow and we start doing a Wilsonian RG. So we start integrating out massive degrees of freedom, starting from the UV and going down. We will obtain some effective action, the Wilsonian effective action S effective, which is just defined as minus log Z with part of the path integral actually performed. So we're actually integrating out some of the degrees of freedom. And as long as we only integrate out massive degrees of freedom, then the effective action we obtain should be regular and local in tau. And if we imagine expanding in tau and powers of tau, then the effective action should take a form like this, where I have the part without tau, and then the tau's contribution to the effective action. This is just to define my notation as effective tau, which you can think of as linear term, quadratic terms, et cetera. Under a conformal transformation, or if we do a conformal transformation, we can compute the variation of this effective action with respect to omega, which from the definition is just minus this variation of log z. And in the theory without the dilaton, that would, as we saw before, that would essentially just give me the trace of the stress energy tensor. But with the dilaton, if we expand in tau, then this tau's contribution to the effective action can contribute to this variation. And the concept, and Tao's definition, or by definition, this term will always cancel this other term, and thus guarantee that the theory is conformally invariant at all scales. And so, okay, let me, I have I think one or two slides about that. So, right, so let me start in the simplest case with a trivial metric, no dilaton, right? So I take my effective action, I compute this variation. In the UV, this effect, I'm not integrating anything out, so this is just varying log of z. I get the trace of the UV theory. The UV is a fixed point CFT, so this trace vanishes. Similarly, in the infrared, I just get the trace and it vanishes. But generically, in between, along the RG flow, this trace will not be zero. And the point is that when I introduce the dilaton, I pick up, so in the UV and the IR, I still have just the trace and it vanishes. But in between, I get this extra contribution from the dilaton, which by definition cancels off the trace and guarantees that this variation is zero, so that my theory remains conformally invariant. And so sometimes the dilaton is called a conformal compensator. You define it in such a way to guarantee conformal invariance at all scales. So then what's the Weyl anomaly matching? Well, to see that, we have to introduce a non-trivial metric. So now let me consider a non-trivial metric, but no dilaton. So now, because of the anomaly, the trace will not be zero in the UV or the infrared. But generically, the trace will be different in the UV and the infrared because the central charges will be different. That's because of the RG flow. And the point is that if we then introduce the dilaton, roughly speaking, the dilaton cancels off the contribution to this variation from the RG flow. So the only contribution comes from the anomaly. And in fact, the Atuft anomaly matching tells us that that value must be the same at all scales. So I must always get, at any scale, the value. This variation must just give me the value of the UV anomaly. And that includes all the way down to the IR CFT. So the point of the Weyl anomaly matching is that this contribution from the dilaton effective action must make up for the difference in the trace anomaly. That's our next slide. But at the fixed point, this thing must this variation must give me the difference of the anomalies between the UV and IR fixed points. Now, that's Comer, Gottsky, and Schwimmer, or actually, historically, it was Schwimmer and Tyson who clarified this Weyl anomaly matching. Comer, Gottsky, and Schwimmer used it to prove the A theorem. But our case, okay, what's different in our case? Well, we're interested in these boundary RG flows of some UVB CFT, and so there's two main differences. One is that when we introduce, so we have this, we perturb our UVB CFT by some local operator that's at the boundary. So when we introduce the dilaton, we only introduce it in these boundary couplings in the same way as before, but it's only at the boundary. And this is important. This means that tau is localized at the boundary and depends only on the boundary coordinates y and z. And this is important because in the effective action, this is a big constraint. It means that tau will only have support at the boundary. There could be no bulk terms involving tau. And furthermore, there can be no terms involving normal derivatives of tau in the x direction. Those are big constraints because it limits the number of terms you can write in the infrared. And the other difference is that, of course, the only contribution to our anomaly is from the boundary, right? So we have this trace that splits up into these two terms, and we're doing this boundary RG flow, and the bulk trace is always zero. So in our case, the only difference between the UV and IR Weyl anomalies is from this boundary contribution. So in the UV, we'll have this the form that I wrote before, with some values of C1 and C2. And in the infrared, we'll have the same form generically with different values of C1 and C2. That's the only change in the anomaly. Right, so now we, just to, for the proof, we just follow Comer, Gottsky, and Schwimmer, essentially. And so I have one slide to explain what's going to happen next. We're going to consider tau's contribution to the effective action, and we're going to be interested in one particular term for reasons that will become clear, the term quadratic in tau and with two derivatives. And I should say this is the Laplacian built from the induced metric. And again, just following these guys, what we're going to do is write this term in two different ways. The first way, we're going to use Weyl anomaly matching to show that the coefficient of this term is proportional to the difference of C1 between the UV and the infrared. And then we're going to write it a different way, where we can use reflection positivity to show that the coefficient of this term must be non-negative. And then just equating those two forms will give us our monotonicity theorem. Okay, so that's what's going to happen. Okay, so let's start writing down tau's contributions to the effective action. So as I said before, the linear term is easy because the linear term just couples to the trace, and actually, because of Weyl anomaly matching, it must couple to the difference in the trace between the UV and the infrared, which I've written here. And then there are higher order terms. So now, if I perform a conformal transformation, the key points, tau will just shift linearly. The extrinsic curvature term is type B, so it doesn't change, but the type A term, r hat, picks up this total derivative. And so then I can do two integration by parts to move this Laplacian from omega over to tau. And then I can compute my variation. And what I'll find is the term that I want, just this difference of the trace, but I'll also pick up another term that I don't want, involving this Laplacian acting on tau. So how do we fix this problem? Well, following Komor-Gottsky and Schwimmer, we go to the order tau squared term and look at the Knobloch squared tau, or tau Knobloch squared tau term, and fix its coefficient in such a way as to cancel off this term. And that's a very easy exercise, so here's the answer. Okay, so I claim if the tau Knobloch squared tau term has this coefficient, then when I do the conformal transformation, I'll get the answer that I want. And okay, one key point about this is that if I take the flat space limit, so I send the metric back to just the Euclidean flat metric, the first term will vanish because all the curvature will vanish, but this term will not. This term actually survives in that limit, and so it can affect flat space physics. Okay, so that's the first way. I mean, I have achieved what I claimed. I've shown that the Weyl anomaly matching fixes this coefficient to be this difference. So now let's write this same term, the tau squared, or the order tau squared, Knobloch squared term, a different way. So starting now, I'll set the metric to be flat. So we just think of our partition function z as integral over the field of our theory of e to the minus s, including tau. And I can expand in tau, as I mentioned before. And then I can think of my effective action, minus log z, as an expectation value, or minus the expectation value of this operator, e to the minus integral of tau times the trace plus the higher order terms, in the theory with tau equals zero. So I can just think of this as an insertion of this operator, or in other words, that's good enough. So I want to study the term with two taus and two derivatives. So how do I get that? Well, I take this expectation value, I expand it in tau. So I get one minus this linear term, which just has the expectation value of the trace. Plus this second order term, which has integral over x, integral over y, tau at x, tau at y, and then the two-point function of the trace, and then all the higher order terms. And at first, this might look non-local because I have these two integrals. But what we can do is we can take this tau of y and we can Taylor expand it about x. And if we do that, and since I'm only interested in the two-derivative term, when I do that expansion, I pick out the two-derivative term, like this, and then all of the y dependence goes into this over here, factor in brackets, integral over y of y minus x rho, y minus x sigma times the two-point function. Okay, now one comment about the two-point function. Again, the trace splits up into bulk and boundary terms, and the bulk part of the trace vanishes. So in this two-point function, the only contribution is from the boundary trace. And reflection positivity tells me that, in fact, this whole thing on the left, the full trace, just the two-point function of a scalar. So that should be non-negative, which in particular tells me that this two-point function of the boundary trace should be non-negative for our boundary RG flows where the bulk trace vanishes. And then the last step, here's where I have to assume that I have a planar boundary, because I need to use the translation invariance along the boundary, essentially just to shift the integration variable of this y integration to get rid of the x dependence. So I shift y to get rid of x, and I rewrite this integral in this way as just 1 half of a Kronecker delta rho sigma integral over y of a delta function at the boundary of y squared times this two-point function of the boundary trace. And here again, reflection positivity, because I know this two-point function should be non-negative from reflection positivity, and it's multiplying manifestly positive things, I know that this integral must be non-negative. And I should also mention that it converges for essentially the same reasons as in a two-dimensional quantum field theory. Just to say it in words, I mean, as long as the deformation from the UV fixed point is genuinely relevant, so it's dimension less than two, and as the approach to the IR CFT or BCFT is genuinely irrelevant, then the powers of Y that appear here will guarantee that the integral converges. Right, but the point is, the upshot is that I've now written this two derivative term, the two tau two derivative term, in two different ways, so I can just equate them. And therefore equate their coefficients, so it allows me to write this difference of C1 as this integral, which I know is non-negative from reflection positivity, and so I immediately get my monotonicity theorem for C1. And that's our main result. So, and I should say that this whole proof that I just presented to you is precisely what Comer, Godsky, and Schwimmer did. I set up the problem in such a way that I could essentially just steal their entire proof for free. Okay, but of course, this isn't exactly a two-dimensional theory. So in what sense does C1 count degrees of freedom? Well, for example, we can add a single real free scalar field or Dirac fermion at the boundary. And at least with my normalizations, what will happen in that case is 24 pi times C1 will shift by 1. And C2 will be unchanged. This is essentially, you can just, if you imagine the action for such a scalar field or Dirac fermion, it will only depend on the induced metric. It doesn't know anything about extrinsic curvature, so C2 doesn't change. But I want to emphasize, okay, so C1 provides some measure, at least, of free fields at the boundary, localized at the boundary. But I want to emphasize that both C1 and C2 are also sensitive to boundary conditions on bulk field, much like G. Right, so here's my example again of a boundary RG flow from a, just to illustrate this, this is a boundary RG flow from a single real free massless scalar in the UV with Neumann, boundary conditions down, down to a single real free massless scalar in the infrared with Dirichlet. So in this case, so what is the value of C1 for these boundary conditions? Well, luckily, Takayanagi and collaborators computed this back in 2012. So in the UV, they found, with my normalization, 1 over 24 pi times 7 over 16 in the UV. And then in the infrared, they found minus 1 over 24 pi times 1 over 16. So the two comments about that are, one, that okay, it obeys the monotonicity theorem. But it also raises the question, similar to the G theorem, of whether C1 is bounded from below and whether it should be. And this is actually a question that we're working on, although we're not certain what the answer is. I'm not sure. There's some zeta function that they do. This is a, if you look at this paper, they don't actually compute it themselves. They steal some heat kernel calculations from other people, which involves some zeta function regularization, which I think is ultimately where these numbers come from. I don't know if that answers your question. And lastly, I guess I have enough time. You can generalize all of this to defects in the following way. So consider, for example, a local reflection positive CFT in any number of dimensions d greater than or equals to 3 with a two-dimensional planar defect, so some kind of plane. It could be a plane where there are some degrees of freedom supported there, or it could be a plane where you impose some boundary conditions on the bulk fields. And in particular, we're going to consider what's called a conformal defect, which will preserve some conformal symmetry. And in fact, we're going to consider a defect that preserves the maximal subgroup that's possible, maximal subgroup of the conformal group. So in d dimensions, the conformal group is SOD plus 1, comma 1. And the maximal subgroup that a two-dimensional planar defect could preserve is SO3, comma 1 times SOD minus 2, where the SO3, comma 1 is just the subset of conformal transformations that preserve the location of the defect. And the SOD minus 2 is just rotations about the defects in the directions transverse to the defect. And a CFT with such a conformal defect is called a defect CFT. And the key ingredient for the proof is, you know, the Weyl anomaly. So the question is, what's the form of that? Here's the answer. And there's two differences from the boundary case. One is trivial. It's just that the extrinsic curvature gets an extra index mu. So there's now an extrinsic curvature for each normal direction. But more interesting is you pick up a third term where this W, it's the bulk vial tensor pulled back to the boundary, and then you just trace over some of the indices using the induced metric. So in the defect case, at least when D is bigger than 3, you get 3 boundary central charges, C1, C2, and C3. And the key point is that this term, this third term that you pick up is B-type. Hopefully that's obvious because the vial tensor is conformally invariant. And since in the proof the crucial term was the A-type term, R hat, the proof essentially goes through unchanged. This term is pretty innocuous in the proof. It just along for the ride. So the proof is basically unchanged. So our claim is that for this class of theories, when you do a defect RG flow from a UV DCFT to an IR DCFT, you'll find the same monotonicity theorem for this coefficient C1. So that's an easy way to generalize this result to a much larger class of theories. Right, so now I'll finish. I guess I won't read all of this. For these classes of theories that I explained, the vial anomaly takes this form. And for these boundary or defect RG flows that preserve locality and the Euclidean symmetry of the problem, we claim that this coefficient in the anomaly, C1, will obey some monotonicity theorem. And it's just a weak form. You can think of this either as a higher dimensional G theorem, as I advertised earlier, or you can think of it as a generalization of the weak form of Zamolodnikov C theorem to include coupling to a higher dimensional CFT. And our proof used only existing ingredients. Actually, everything we used was already in the literature. You just had to read the right papers and put them together. That's good because we didn't have to do much work. That's bad because we have no original ideas of our own. And that's a serious problem because what this field really needs are some new ideas. It's very unsatisfying that all these different proofs of monotonicity theorems look so different in different dimensions. If they're really all coming from just basic things like reflection positivity and Euclidean symmetry, it seems like there should be some general proof for all of them, some kind of universal proof where you can prove all of them in a single fell swoop. So for the future, okay, there are some immediate questions like, can we define a C1 function away from the fixed points and prove that it's monotonic? Can we prove whether C1 is bounded from below or not? And what about other methods of proof? For example, what about using entanglement entropy or holography? I would like to have at least one more proof that would make me much more confident in the result. And we're working on those. And also, I want to apply this result to the examples that I mentioned and to others, just to see what we can learn about the low-energy physics in these cases. And then finally, just more generally speaking, of course, for the future, what you want to do is try and prove more boundary and defect monotonicity theorems. And there are lots of proposals in the literature. And as I said, it would be very nice to find some kind of universal proof for all of them at once. So for example, Myers and Sinha, they proposed looking at entanglement entropy. More recently, Giambi and Klebanov proposed looking at the partition function times some special factors. And then lastly, I think a question that might actually be more tractable, this one's a pretty hard problem. I think one that might be more tractable is just to ask, or to try and answer this question, do monotonicity theorems always survive coupling to higher dimensional CFTs? So if I assume that some monotonicity theorem exists, regardless of whether it's proven, just assume it exists, couple it to a higher dimensional CFT. Can you prove that it survives that coupling? And with that, I am done. So thank you.
Do we have an example where you can see how C2 changes, if there's any interesting properties
of C2? I thought of that last night, and I didn't have time to look it up. It's in Taki and Agi's paper. For that case, he computed C2, I think. And I just can't remember if it goes up or down.
OK. Or if that one is bounded. I'm trying to figure out what C2 means from the point of view of the 2D CFT, and if it has some interpretation.
I don't know. There are people have actually written papers about C2. People have studied it in cosmology. People have studied it because they were thinking, I forget, it was either cosmic strings or some kind of domain walls. People are, yeah, well, where's the form, where's the anomaly? There it is. People are actually usually not interested in this term because they dismiss it. They just say, oh, it's topological. These terms are more interesting because they're actually sensitive to the geometry. One example I know off the top of my head, here's an interesting question. This was Gary Gibbons and two other people whose names I forget. So they said, okay, consider a four-dimensional theory and compute the entanglement entropy. Right? The entangling surface will be some Riemann surface. And in four dimensions, usually the first term will be the area law term, area over cutoff squared. And then the next term will be the log term. And then there's a bunch of terms you don't really care about. So then, and the key point is that what they asked was, well, okay, the first key point is that the coefficients of the log term will actually have this form. And if you want, you can think of that as just the statement that if you use twist fields, even though they're usually non-local, you can think of them as some kind of two-dimensional defect. And so they produce, and the coefficient of the log term, roughly speaking, is usually the trace anomaly. So you kind of expect this form. Only in that case, C1 and C2 are fixed in terms of the central charges of the 4D theory. So they're actually fixed in terms of A and C. And then they ask the question of, well, okay, if we fix the area, so we don't care of the surface, you don't care about the area term. And then you want to, say, minimize the entropy, but this term's topological, so minimizing doesn't mean anything, but you end up extremizing this term. And that's precisely it's related to the Willmore problem, so you get into some interesting mathematics. And so they're actually interested in this term, and there's also, for similar reasons, people wanted to know, I can give you the papers. They were studying it in cosmology because they were studying, again, either cosmic strings or domain walls. I'm getting my codimension wrong, but they wanted to know the value of this C2 because they wanted to use it as some kind of measure of the degrees of freedom living on your defect. But it wasn't clear that in what sense that's. And I guess we would be disagreeing with that and saying, well, you should really look at C1. I can show you the papers if you're really interested.
So what about generalization concepts?
Well, that's a good question. You won't be able to use this method because one-dimensional. Generically, such a thing will not contribute to the trace anomaly, and that was the crucial thing in our case. So you'd have to use some other method. And while I'm talking, you can also study. I get asked a lot, okay, what about, we studied a 3D theory with a boundary. What about a 4D theory with a boundary? This is actually what Giotto, his proposal was about, some boundary F theorem. And in that case, if you try to do it this way, you can compute the Weyl anomaly. It's different because now the bulk is 4D, boundary is 3D. So there's a bulk anomaly now, which was not there in this case. That's not a huge problem as long as you only consider a boundary or G flow. The bulk anomaly won't change. The bulk central charges will be the same. The problem is that with a three-dimensional boundary, there are some B-type terms, and again, you don't care about the B-type terms. They're interesting for mathematics, but not for physics, I guess. there is an A-type term, but it's not interesting because its coefficient is fixed by the bulk central charge A. Because it's really the Euler character of the four-dimensional theory on a space with the boundary, not just, and the Euler density includes a boundary term. So. And then you can also, and if anybody's looking for a project, you can consider a five-dimensional CFT with a boundary and try to prove a boundary A theorem using these techniques. And we're pretty sure it'll work, but we were not interested because there's no real system that's described by a five-dimensional CFT. Sorry to ramble.